You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Today, we are in Nancy.
Better get a personal apology for that.
I'm going in a straight line. I moved out of the way to let the sprinters do their sprint, and he took me out.
That was the sound of Andrew Talansky after the finish of the seventh stage of the Tour de France. He came off in the finishing straight, blamed Simon Gerrans, and was pretty angry. My name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freib.
Hi, Richard.
Daniel, you caught that. You captured that bit of audio, being the ace reporter that you are. Can you explain a little bit about can you describe the scene? Paint a picture in words?
Well, at the risk of doing Lionel's job, we're actually in a square in Nancy, just very close to the finish line, and it was just outside and where we're standing at the moment that scene unfolded. Andrew Talansky rode past the Orica Green Edge bus, which was very conveniently parked next to the Garmin bus, not parked under finish line gantry this time, and he shouted in the general direction of the Orica Green Edge bus that he wanted an apology, as we heard there. Julian Dean, the former New Zealand sprinter slash lead out man, now works for Orica Green Edge, and that was who you heard there.
Lionel looked very affronted there when you were describing the scene. Daniel, that's obviously his job.
I didn't go into a lot of detail, Lionel. Do you want to pick it up there?
It's nice to be in Nancy after being in Reims last night. I've been practicing that. I got some lessons from the lady who introduces the podcast. Quite pleased with that now. Anyway, we're in Nancy now. Lionel, where are we specifically?
Well, we are, as Daniel says, next to quite a nice square with an obelisk in it. We're standing outside a bar.
A square with an obelisk in it.
You can't, absolutely. I wonder what it's a monument to. And we're just having a post-stage beer. The Tour de France is packing up around us, ready to move just down the road to Tomblaine, where it starts in the morning.
So it was an exciting stage today. Not an awful lot was expected today. I watched a bit of video diary-type stuff from Geraint Thomas and Richie Porte. Geraint Thomas does a pretty good job with these little video diaries. He's a very calm, assured presenter, perhaps future podcast participant material there. But he did a little video diary with Richie Porte, and they were very dismissive of journos, as they called us, journos, describing these kind of stages as transition stages. They view it as a sort of pejorative term, where the implication is that these stages are quite easy and routine and straightforward, and they're not. And today certainly wasn't. There were two climbs, it was a very long stage, and there were two climbs towards the end. And it's been a very nervous opening, not so much the first few days, but the crashes have multiplied over the last few days. And there was a terrible one today with TJ Van Garderen in the final 20 kilometres, very like Chris Froome's crash a few days ago on Tuesday. He just went down near the front of the bunch. He was exactly where he should be. They always say the safest place is at the front. He was in the second or third row. Down he went very heavily. He lost just over a minute. That affects his overall chances, obviously. In the final couple of climbs, we saw Saxo Tinkoff move to the front. We saw a lot of sprinters drop. We expected Cannondale to really take it on there for Peter Sagan, but Saxo Tinkoff kind of did their job for them. And I spoke to Michael Rogers at the finish about what the tactic had been there, whether it's to protect Alberto Contador rather than to actually be aggressive, and how he was looking forward to the next few days.
You're very aggressive again today. Was that just to keep Alberto out of trouble there towards the end?
Yes, certainly. I just had to go, 5 minutes full there, and just to keep the positions. If you've got a clean road in front of you, it's, I suppose you're going to get the risk of crashing.
I mean, Alberto's 2.5 minutes down on Nibali. Is he in a good position, do you think, to win the Tour? Do you think Nibali's in a strong position?
I won't lie. It'd be better if we're closer, but, these are the cards we have, unfortunately. Alberto had a few problems on the Pave day. By no means thinks the race is over, and we'll keep supporting our leader 100%.
And a big 3 days ahead of you.
Yeah. Now the race starts. So.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney, and Daniel Freib.
So we heard there from Michael Rogers, Alberto Contador's very experienced Australian teammate at Tinkoff Saxo. Lionel, anything more to add about the stage? I mean, we're going to talk about Talansky's crash, which was a bad one. We're going to talk about Peter Sagan.
Well, yeah, I mean, it came alive in the last 20 kilometres when they reached those two little hills, and they were they were sharper and steeper than I think we perhaps suspected. You look at the figures in the road book, you look at the maps, and you're never quite sure, unless you've seen the road itself, you're never quite sure what you're going to get. But what was interesting was that when, on the final climb, knowing that TJ Van Garderen was chasing back with some teammates from the BMC racing team, Greg Van Avermaet made a move over the top to kind of force a bit of a selection for the stage win. And Richard, you said to me, when Peter Sagan just kind of drifted across onto Van Avermaet's wheel, how easy it looked, and you said, you know, well, I'll just follow that. You know, that's the kind of nonchalant attitude that Sagan's got in these situations. And really, it bears out what Daniel's been saying the last number of days, which is that Peter Sagan is a fantastic bike rider, but he's not yet a fantastic bike racer.
We've not mentioned the stage winner yet, Matteo Trentin, who won the stage. Sagan, as you say, Lionel, got away with Greg Van Avermaet. And this is why we love bike racing. The strongest guy doesn't always win. You know, clearly he was the strongest rider in the race, and he's finished now in the top five in every single stage. I believe, according to our good friend Ciro Scognomiglio, that's the first man to do so since Henri Pélissier 84 years ago. So quite a record, but that won't be any consolation at all for not winning the stage. I mean, he got away with Greg Van Avermaet. They put quite a lot into the break. They got a decent gap, but it came back together, and Sagan still finished second in the sprint, narrowly by less than a centimetre.
But Daniel, do you think that Sagan would have won it had he not made that earlier effort?
Oh, 100%. I mean, we looked at what he lost by. It was centimetres. And, you know, there's no doubt, even Peter Sagan, as kind of superhuman as he can seem sometimes, there's no doubt that he wasted valuable energy in those moves. You know, it was very, very similar to the stage that Nibali won in Sheffield. Big effort on a descent. And I think the weakness of his team, and this will be remedied next year because he will be a much stronger team, but that is a fact. I mean, DeMarchi did a very good job on the final climb pacing him up there. But you ask yourself, would it be different if Sagan looked up the road and he saw three or four teammates on the front and able to control a bunch over that final climb? He, you know, he wouldn't have felt that he needed to make that move. And it's the lack of strength in his team, or it's a lack of a firm hand from the team car, and a lack of clear instructions, or a lack of ability to really relay those instructions in a way that he will listen to them, which stops him, you know, taking better decisions in those situations.
It was an absolute free for all on that descent, wasn't it, with such a wide road. It would have been difficult to control no matter how many guys a team had up there.
You know, you keep the pace very high, and I think you control the race, and they were just not able to do that. So you see, any attack that goes, it's Sagan that moves and marks that attack. And, you know, really the ideal scenario is to have three or four teammates just riding a steady tempo, be it 50 kilometres an hour, 60 kilometres an hour, a very fast tempo, and, you know, to shelter him, because there's no doubt that in that group he was the fastest rider.
But Richard, what did you think of Van Avermaet's move, knowing that the team leader for the GC off the back losing time, and Van Avermaet stretching the race out of the front? It's not conventional, is it?
Yeah, but if it wasn't Van Avermaet, it'd be somebody else. I mean, I don't think you can blame or criticise Van Avermaet for that. There was a stage went up for grabs. It was the kind of stage that would suit him, Daniel.
But Rich, should he not have been at the back of the race helping TJ Van Garderen?
Well, Van Garderen had about three or four teammates with him. Would Van Avermaet's presence have made much of a difference?
I think, you know, two or three extra guys over 10 or 15 kilometres could have made a big difference, could have made 20 seconds, 30 seconds difference.
I think, you know, I mean, is TJ Van Garderen really worth sacrificing the whole team for?
Well, that is something that emerged quite clearly from today's schedule. Well, that was certainly the message that I took, that BMC are not yet confident enough in Van Garderen to put all of their power behind him.
And rightly so. And if Van Avermaet had won the stage, then it would have been a bad day with a silver lining, I think.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
So you're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. We're in Nancy, and we are raking over the ashes of another narrow miss by Peter Sagan. At the start this morning in Epernay, I spoke to Ted King, one of Peter Sagan's teammates at Cannondale, American rider who was very unfortunate last year. He hates being reminded of this, I think, because I don't think he appreciated me asking him questions about it, but he crashed in Corsica and then was outside the time limit in the team time trial in Nice, and was out of the race a day before his family, his parents, arrived to support him. So that was a very sad story last year, but he's here this year. He's surviving. He's crashed like everybody has, but he's surviving. And I spoke to him at the start in Epernay about Peter Sagan and whether he was becoming frustrated at not winning a stage. And then at the finish, I spoke also to Peter Sagan, who reflected on his near miss to Matteo Trentin.
How is Peter? Is he, he's been top five every stage so far, which he might be on course setting some kind of record, but is he frustrated that he's not had the elusive stage win yet?
No, the chief plan is the jersey, right? Obviously, winning stages is going to be pretty fantastic too, and I wouldn't put it out of the question to take some stages. I mean, Peter, you know, recovers exceptionally well, and on top of that, he's not your average sprinter, obviously. So, you know, he's not looking for purely a flat drag race to the finish. You know, a day like today could really suit him. We see what happens.
And what about you? I mean, you had the enormous frustration last year of being eliminated early in the race. Are you pleased with how your tour is going so far? You're pleased, obviously, still to be in it, and I guess your ambition is to get to Paris.
Anxious first few days. I'm a little bit banged up right now. And like I said, there's been an enormous amount of stress these first few days, but that's what the tour is known for. I mean, you know, the first week is always going to be a stressful race. So I'm licking my wounds and optimistic about going all the way to Paris.
Today is the closest you've gone to a stage run. Is it also the most frustrating?
I don't know. Thank you for all my teammates, because they did all day. Was pulling on the front, and I was try attack with Van Avermaet in last climb, but after I was see the group, it was coming till the finish, and I tried to do my best in the sprint, but I was close, but not enough.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
I was waiting in the mix zone at the finish today, where the riders file through and give interviews to different sections of the press, starting with the TV rights holders, working all the way down to press and podcasts, I guess. There isn't a separate section for podcasts yet. We'll have to lobby for that next year, I think.
Well, apparently we're the first standalone podcast to get accreditation for the Tour de France, I gather.
A historic first. I think next year what we'll do is we'll push to be just in front of TV rights holders, Ned Bolting and co. Shove them aside. Ned, friend of the podcast, apart from at the tour, he's a foe of the podcast because he's got a rival podcast, which I shouldn't be giving publicity to. Anyway, I was there with our friend Ciro Scognamiglio of Gazzetta dello Sport, and one of the Tour de France, the head of press, Thomas Carreau, came up to us and said, "This is not the Tour de France, this is the Giro d'Italia." Because not only is Vincenzo Nibali in yellow jersey, but Matteo Trentin won the stage today. And the Italians really are having a great tour on that basis, aren't they?
Yeah, resurgent. And Trentin is someone who has sort of gone under the radar slightly because he's in a Belgian team. He's a real jack of all trades. Obviously, he won a stage last year in Gap.
Lyon.
In a break, you know, we all know how difficult it is to get into a break in the Tour de France, let alone win from a break. Very fast rider, good climber. He lives up in the mountains of Trentino, right in the extreme north of Italy. If you talk to Mark Cavendish about him, Mark Cavendish scratches at head of how he manages to train, because you go out of Trentin's house and one way is up a mountain, the left is up a mountain, right is up a mountain, and then he's got one valley road that he can go on. It's always a bit of a challenge for him to find sort of varied courses to train on. But Cavendish has rated him from the word go when he arrived at Omega Pharma Quickstep. I think they roomed together at the first training camp. Cavendish soon had him doing Sudoku puzzles, and he was soon a devotee of the kind of logic puzzles that Cavendish is a big advocate of.
Well, it suggests not the Sudoku puzzles and stuff, but if he's only got one road to train on, that suggests a high boredom threshold, which is ideal for Grand Tour stage racing. The Tour is won in the head as well as the legs. So, you know, he's last year he saved Italy's Tour de France, didn't he? He won on the whatever it was, the third Saturday out of four. The Giro was despondent almost by that point, wasn't he? With very little.
Giro is ebullient.
He is. He's in the press room now, pacing up and down. He's wearing shorts. He's bought himself a Tour de France T-shirt from the official boutique. He's on the phone. It's glued to his ear.
It's difficult to get Giro. The only downside to that is it's difficult to get Giro on the podcast when he's got to write basically the whole of Gazzetta dello Sport. So let's hope this Italian run comes to an end at some point and we can get him back on the podcast, and also writing the blog that he's promised to write. He's taking his time with that. We're going to have to put the pressure on a little bit.
Yeah, he appeared over my shoulder at one point saying, "Daniel, what is it, this blog? What do I write?"
Good to know he's been really well briefed then, obviously.
I say, give us 500 or 600 words on Vincenzo Nibali, please, and make it quick. But anyway, hopefully he'll come up with a good soon. So, Talansky, yeah, that was a heavy fall. He'll be hurt.
It was a heavy fall and quite some... Would we call it a tantrum after the finish line? I mean, we know that he's a bit of a hothead. He's sort of cycling's equivalent of... Well, it's kind of Jimmy Connors meets John McEnroe, isn't he? As Jonathan Vorter said, he was... Well, Talansky was sort of ushered, bustled onto the bus by another friend of the podcast, Matthew Rabin, who's the chiropractor at Garmin Sharp. Talansky seemed quite happy to stand outside the bus and argue the toss for another half hour or so, but he was bustled onto the bus, which is probably a good PR move from Garmin Sharp. And Jonathan Vorter's informed us that he wouldn't be coming out to speak to the press, and again, probably another smart move. But Jonathan did say the pit bull, that's Andrew Talansky's nickname, is off the leash in there.
It does show just how the media and the Tour de France and is changing, because we were all stood outside the Garmin Sharp bus. Jonathan's talking very calmly to the TV and to the other journalists and really diffusing the situation. And by the time I'd walked back to the press centre, tweets had gone backwards and forwards between Jonathan and Orica Greenedge, apologising and sort of sharing the blame and just diffusing the whole situation rather than inflaming it. Remember 2009, was it, when...
Tanner Farrar got on the bus, didn't he?
Again, the peacemaker / bouncer / vigilante in that case was Matthew Rabin.
Was it really? I'll tell you what, I kind of lament Twitter, because Twitter allows people to, as well as causing some arguments, Twitter also allows people to apologise in public very quickly, and these feuds aren't allowed to develop as feuds used to develop.
Well, the incident I was actually referring to was when the Garmin team chased down George Hincapie, yes. When George Hincapie had the chance to win the yellow jersey, and there was this whole kind of American battle in, was it Besançon? I think it was. Battle in Besançon. It was a great day. We went, I remember driving out to the Garmin team hotel to talk to Matt White, who said, oh no, very busy, we've got a team meeting scheduled for tonight, you know, we're not talking about any of that. And it's like, well, you know, this is the biggest story on the Tour de France. But now, with Twitter, Jonathan, ever the diplomat, really, in these situations, but very savvy at kind of managing these stories. It was clever, but it's a shame, because what we really want is a roaring...
What they call in Glasgow, a rammy. That's what we want. And Twitter, if it's been 1985, St Etienne, when Bernardino blamed Phil Anderson for knocking him off, Phil Anderson would be tweeting his apologies and Bernardino would be tweeting him back saying, it's okay, Phil. Yeah. But as it is, that feud has been stewing for 30 years now, and long may it continue.
But let's look at the incident in itself, because obviously Talansky fell very hard. Talansky was up there. His line was that he was trying to get out of the way of the sprinters. Jonathan Vorter said afterwards that the problem in that group was that all of the proper sprinters had been shelled out on the hills. The proper sprinters' team trains weren't there, so it was a real free-for-all. And Talansky said he was trying to move over to get out of the way so those guys could do their sprint.
Julian Dean, who was the sort of peacemaker stroke...
Agent provocateur,
okay. Well, he once drifted across Mark Renshaw, and Renshaw headbutted him and was...
Very true.
Excluded. So he knows what it's like in those situations. Daniel, I think we can hear from Simon Gerrans.
We can, Richard. Here's Simon Gerrans giving his version of that crash and responding to... Andrew Talansky's demand for an apology.
Yeah, I think he fell over my back wheel there in the final 100 metres or so, and I think when you watch the footage you can see there's absolutely nothing intentional about it, and I don't think either of us really did too much wrong. It was just an unfortunate thing that happened under the circumstances, and yeah, I'm sorry for Andrew that he crashed, but I think when he sees the footage he'll see that so there was nothing too extreme about it. Well, I think as you saw, we were just in a pretty select group sprinting for the win there, and yeah, I just saw the footage afterwards. I saw that Talansky went down, and I'm sorry that he crashed, but as everyone saw, there was nothing malice about it. And I don't think I did anything wrong. And I think once he sees what happens too, he could see that I moved from the left to the right and he was moving from the right to the left, and he just followed my back. Today was a good indication. Unfortunately, I didn't get up for a place there, but that's the best I've felt since stage one, so that's all looking good moving forward. Oh, it was a really hectic finish. I think there were quite a few crashes starting from the top of the second to last climb, so yeah, a lot of guys are pretty desperate out there and there was a lot of falls, so it's unfortunate.
Podcast daily during the Tour de France. This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
We were talking quite a bit in that last segment about Jonathan Vauters, and remember, you can win a phone call from Jonathan Vauters. He promises heavy breathing. You can win a phone call from him on the rest day. We ran this competition last year. It was very successful. I think the winner enjoyed the phone call from Jonathan Vauters. I think later in the tour, we're also going to be offering a phone call from Dan Martin, who's not riding the tour, but nevertheless is excellent on the phone. So when a call from Jonathan Vauters, tweet at cycling_podcast # JV call and explain in fewer than 140 characters, obviously, or however many you have left, why Jonathan Vauters should speak to you. What can you offer Jonathan Vauters? We've had some very imaginative entries so far. Thank you for them. Competition excluded from entry are David Miller and H. Verbruggen of Holland.
And Bradley Wiggins.
And Bradley Wiggins as well. No, he's allowed to enter, actually. We also have another competition. You win a pair of Oakleys, special edition Tour de France, Raider Lock Path Oakleys.
They're the ones, I think, with the yellow, green and polka dot stripe just below the lens. I think Geraint Thomas was wearing them yesterday.
No doubt, they're very, very nice indeed, and they're very expensive. I looked them up on Google, and they are £255 English pounds. You can win those by liking us on Facebook. So go and find us on Facebook, and all you have to do is like us. Please like us.
It can even be insincere, can't it?
It doesn't have to be sincere. It doesn't have to be sincere at all.
No, you can just want the glasses more than us. That's fine.
You can unlike us as soon as the competition's over with your fancy Oakleys. So please like us on Facebook.
If only we could have like and unlike in the Tour de France Jaguar, Richard. We'd be liking and unliking each other 8, 10, 15 times a day.
We would, at least. Also, we're on. We've got a website, thecyclingpodcast.com, and we are blogging daily there. I think you've written a blog today, Lionel.
Well, I have. I was just going to tee up a few minutes of my chat with Jens Voigt, or Jens Voigt, as we are supposed to say, because that's how the Germans pronounce his surname. Daniel, pronunciation police, is that okay?
Yeah,
Voigt. So, yeah, I spoke to Jens this morning. Just a really easy guy to chat to. He's very happy to come out of the bus. He was first out of the bus, and the reason for that was because he's an old guy, long stage ahead. He likes to get out, sign on, and then get back in the bus and eat his last-minute food at the right time before the start so that he's properly fueled and hydrated for a long day in the saddle. He confirmed that this is his last Tour de France. I think we all kind of knew that that was on the cards, but
we kind of knew it last year as well.
We kind of did know it last year, yeah, but he did say in the winter and on the eve of the Tour de France that this would probably be his last, but today he actually said, no, this is the last one. So this is my chat with Jens Voigt. Jens, the first one ready. You're so keen to get on with it today.
Well, I guess it's a long day, so I might as well get ready in time, do my sign-on, and then trying to, yeah, squeeze some more food into me to be ready for this 6 hours on a bike today.
You're looking very trim. Is there any room to squeeze any food in?
Well, yeah, I mean, you cannot arrive fat to the Tour de France. You got to be pretty much in race shape to arrive at the Tour. Otherwise, you're too low in weight, too low on energy after the first week. But yeah, you've got to keep refilling the engine.
Now think back to Yorkshire. Did you enjoy your experience there? You were out on the road by yourself for a long time. The crowds were amazing.
Definitely it was a highlight. The last time we have seen something like that was probably in 2007 when we had to start in London. It was pretty much amazing to see just the sheer amount, you know, just the numbers of people on the roadside. And even when we left England on Monday, I mean, that's a working day, and the roads were still packed with people, so it was brilliant.
You've experienced a lot of Tour de France's in your career, but does that rank as one of the highlights?
Yeah, I would definitely say so, yes, absolutely. As I say, amongst London, and then we had one start in France, Saint Puy de Fou, or whatever that was called.
Le Puy de Fou.
Yeah, Le Puy de Fou, voilà, exact. Yeah, that one was also pretty cool.
I've been enjoying your blog on bicycling.com. Very nice to see some insight from inside the race. Often you're telling your story from the massage table at the end of the day. Yesterday you were a little bit critical of one team for quick stepping at the front when some riders had crashed.
Yes, because I sort of would be sort of a common agreement if there's one crash with 10 guys on the ground and just two corners further down the descent, so another 30 on the ground or blocked behind it, that the race would slow down, we would wait for them. I mean, it's not that the enemy is laying back there. It's your friends, your colleagues, maybe your roommate, maybe one of your teammates is laying there. It's not that it's just like the others that, you know, anonymous numbers of the peloton. No, they are our colleagues, our friends, and I was missing some respect there, yeah, to give them a chance to come back.
So has cycling changed in your time as a professional? Is it more cutthroat now on occasions?
Sometimes it seems to be to get a little more rough or a little less relaxed, and people give like a little less space or respect to each other. And sometimes decisions you would take with just common sense, they are not made like that anymore. So much at stake. It's a tour. Everything is super important, and whenever you can get a little advantage, some people or some teams might just want to go for the smallest possible advantage at whatever cost or whatever it takes. And yeah, you could say on one side that's just how cycling is or how that's sport, but you could also on the other hand say, no, I don't like this development so much.
Now, are you fed up with people telling you that you're the oldest man in the race? But you also on your team have the youngest man in the race, Danny Van Poppel, who was 1 year old when you won the Peace Race in 1994. Sorry to rub that in a little bit.
Wow, that's a long time gap. Well, and as you can see, Peace Race like a dinosaur, extincted. It's not alive anymore. Hopefully I get away from the extinction. Hopefully I only retire and don't extinct. Danny has a brilliant future ahead of him. Yesterday he was clearly set up for a podium place, and he punctured with 1.9 kilometers to go, and of course there's no bike change fast enough to give him a chance to come back. So that was our sprint finish, our stage yesterday. But yeah, he was right there on the wheel of Cancellara and Gregory Rust to lead him out. And then we punctured, so that's a bummer, but definitely Danny has a great future ahead.
If he'd ridden the 1994 Peace Race, you'd definitely have beaten him as well, though. You can always tell him that.
Hopefully, yes. Hopefully.
Now, lastly, Henri Paré holds the record for the oldest rider to finish the Tour de France.
Who's
I don't
that?
Know if you know this. Henri Paré.
Yeah.
He was 50 years old in 1904 when he finished the race. Giovanni Rossignoli was 44 years old in 1927, which is kind of the oldest in, we can't say the modern era, but certainly the oldest that you could perhaps catch up. Do you plan to carry on?
Well, I would say modern era starts somewhere after Second World War. Before it was more the classic era, you know, where they had radio transmissions and no TV or black and white TV. I wouldn't call it the modern era. But no, of course, I'm not going to make it. But I believe my body could do it a little longer, but my head just don't want to do it anymore. So I'm happy that end of this year I can say goodbye.
So the Champs-Élysées will be your farewell to the Tour de France, potentially?
Definitely. Well, in a function as an active pro rider, maybe I come back in another function to that race. But as a bike rider, no, 17, it's enough. I mean, that is something like 300. If you count out the stages where I crashed or I abandoned because of sickness, if I arrive in Paris this year, it will be that I have done 340 stages in the Tour de France. That's almost a year of my life, just tour stages. So I guess that's a good point to say, no, that's enough now.
Wow, that's a lot.
interviews, and analysis, we've got the Tour de France covered. This is a Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. We're here in Nancy, and we are looking ahead now briefly to entering the Vosges Mountains. Is it the Vosges or the Dolomites, Daniel?
Richard, it's very definitely the Vosges. Going to Gérard Mer. Last time the tour was at Gérard Mer, you remember what happened? Yeah. The Col de la Schlucht, Armstrong's team completely disintegrated over the Col de la Schlucht. Peter Wiening went away with Andreas Klöden, who
2005.
Is not... 2005. He's not a friend of the podcast. We'd very much like him to be a friend of the podcast. And tomorrow...
Another photo finish, wasn't it? It was a real, real close finish.
It was very close. But tomorrow is actually a harder stage, harder finish. It'll be interesting because they're two very, very steep climbs at the end there. A bit of sort of difference of opinion about whether it's going to be a day for the GC guys to sort of show their cards, whether it's going to be more of a stage for likes of Simon Gerrans. A lot of the GC contenders have not recce'd tomorrow's stage, which I think is perhaps a mistake, and that applies to all of the stages in the Vosges. There are three.
But you think the riders of the Tour de France should recce every stage, which would mean riding the Tour de France before they'd ridden the Tour de France?
I am absolutely mystified by riders recceing stages like the Wanta Horsacam, which goes over the Tourmalet, which they do every year. And you know, just on recces, there is this kind of misconception that it's a new phenomenon. In one of my books, Mountain High, I forget the name of the gentleman, but the people were doing recces. There was one particular gentleman who rode all of the stages of the Tour of Switzerland in the, I think, the 1930s or 40s. So it has been around since the beginning of time.
A gentleman. On recces, I had an interesting little chat with Chris Baldwin, the press officer at Astana, who's a very busy man, and he was talking a little bit about the cobbled stage and about the different approach to recceing that Astana took compared to Saxo. Saxo did it the day after Paris-Roubaix, and there were a lot of press there, a lot of photographers, and he felt that Contador rode the cobbles at quite a leisurely pace, whereas when Astana did it with Nibali a couple of days later, they rode at a full race pace, and they really tried to replicate the sort of conditions they would have for the stage itself. He believes that Contador and Tinkoff Saxo went back a little bit later and actually did do a proper recce. But interesting little perhaps a contrast there. I mean, over the next few days we will see the overall contenders. I mean, even today, you know, on small climbs we saw Tinkoff Saxo have a real presence at the front with Contador. Contador is looking like a tour champion in waiting in a way. But Nibali is also looking very strong, and crucially, neither of those two have crashed. You know, and that we've talked about this a lot, but that is often an essential ingredient in winning the tour.
I think the other thing that bears mentioning, particularly in Nibali's case, is he's someone who's he takes everything in his stride. He's very laid back. You know, we've talked about what a fantastic racer he is. You know, I believe that he should have recce'd the next three stages in the Vosges. He should have probably recce'd the stages in Great Britain. He still won in Sheffield. And, you know, that's just the character he is. Where, you know, we do see riders who are very kind of meticulous, very diligent, and they need that for sort of their, you know, mental serenity before going into stage. They need to know exactly what they're doing. That's probably not the case with Nibali.
Is this why you know where you're staying tonight and the next night and the next night? You've recce'd all your hotels as we go around the tour.
Just book them, actually. It's not too late for Nibali to recce in the next few stages. Maybe he's doing tomorrow's as we speak.
Well, we did talk, didn't we, the other day about how we were surprised that Ciro was surprised that Astana are sending Paolo Slongo, who is Nibali's coach, ahead of the race to give feedback, you know, 3 or 4 hours before the race arrives via text message about, you know, things he might see on the course. I mean, there are teams that have been doing this for many years now.
I remember in 2009, of course, Bradley Wiggins surprisingly found himself in contention for the tour and hadn't recce'd the final time trial in Annecy. And on the rest day, I think his team Garmin arranged a helicopter over to Annecy for him to recce the stage. So he did recce that stage during the tour. So it's not. Shall we wrap this up?
Yeah,
we need to go. We need to go and find our hotels. Daniel's staying in a very nice, fancy hotel tonight, and I think we're in a bit of a dive, Lionel. But never mind.
We may be in with some teams. I think we might be in with Europe Car. That may be me misreading. I think we're in with Europe Car at some point.
Just lastly, chaps, the champagne last night. What did you end up drinking?
Champagne.
You didn't make any note of what it was, whether it was brute, Blanc de Blanc.
I did actually, Daniel.
We can confirm it was the second cheapest one.
That Lionel brought me this morning, which was an awful overfilled cup.
Well, I didn't remember you have milk
into the saucer.
I didn't remember you have milk in your coffee, so I didn't leave room.
Local champagne.
Okay, yeah, I approve of that.
You want to say what it is, Daniel?
I got power if it's.
We.
It was very nice indeed. The second bottle went down extremely well.
The vintage.
We're on a budget here, Daniel, you know, come on. Anyway, let's wrap it up. We're podcasting every day, of course, and we'll be back tomorrow in the mountains. But for today, thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.